this month. The easiest would be to check out Venus. Venus is at its brightest. It only reaches maximum brightness about once every 3.5 years. But when it's at maximum brightness, you can see it in the daytime. Now, it's only at maximum brightness when it's a morning star. When it's an evening star, it kind of pales in comparison to what it looks like when it's visible in the morning. So if you happen to be up and awake at 5 a.m., it'll be truly spectacular. Even at 6 a.m., it's quite spectacular. Any day.
Any day.
Yeah.
Only on Tuesdays.
Look towards the east. Look towards the east. Yeah, it's a star in the east. Okay, so look towards the east. Planet east, that is. You won't miss it. It'll be the brightest thing in the sky besides the sun and the moon. In fact, if you're in a dark location, you can try a little experiment. You should be able to read a newspaper by the light of Venus. So, if you've never seen Venus as a bright morning star, this is a good time to check it out. In fact, it hit maximum brightness a couple of weeks ago, so it's actually getting dimmer every day, but it's still quite a good sight. So, and one thing that's kind of fun, you pick it up at, say, 5 or 6 in the morning, and then you kind of watch it move across the sky as the Earth rotates. You should be able to see it right up until about 11:30 a.m., if you know where to look. So, it's the only planet that you can see with the naked eye in the daytime. But, yeah, you will have to know where to look. Yes.
Can't you also see it not full, but like a crescent?
It's brightest when it's a crescent, because it's a planet that rotates or revolves between us and the sun. It's closest to us when it's in the almost new phase. So what you actually see, if you look at it through a telescope, is a very thin crescent. But because it's so close, the crescent is actually brighter than when, say, Venus is on the opposite side of the sun. If you were to have Mars and Venus trade places, Venus would be so bright it would interfere with nighttime telescope observations, because then it would be brightest when it was full, as it is brightest when it's on the when it's in the crescent phase. But yeah, this is the time to catch Venus at its brightest, because otherwise you've got to wait more than 3 years before it'll be that bright again. Yes.
Yeah, well, we're in the subject of a heavenly body. When I was in Peru, and this happened to Ted also, and everybody was there, you know, you're up at 13,000 feet. I came out at night, and I looked up, and I saw the Milky Way. It's coming like over my right shoulder like this, like a roll, and right down like that. And I could see the individual stars. But you know what was funny? I looked at it, and I looked like it was separate from me. I wasn't in it, because it was, you know, coming like that, and it didn't look like, you know, like I was in it.
Well, the Milky Way in the southern hemisphere is nothing like the Milky Way in the northern hemisphere. It's much more spectacular. And so people who go into the southern hemisphere, they're stunned by how intense the Milky Way is. But the southern sky is much brighter than the northern sky in terms of the Milky Way. Well, yeah, if you've got a really good night sky, you can actually see the individual arms of the Milky Way galaxy. And if your eyes, if you look in the right direction, you should be able to easily see the large and small Magellanic Clouds, as well as the globular cluster 47 Tucani. It's right next to the small Magellanic Cloud. So, yeah, visiting the southern hemisphere is a real treat, but one thing you've got to get used to is the fact that all the constellations are upside down. So, seeing Orion upside down is kind of an interesting experience.
You can see the haze like here. You see it, and it's kind of hazy and blurry, and it looks like milk. You know?
Well, if you want to go to the best possible observing site in the world, I think I talked about this in the class, they found a ridge in Antarctica that is by far the most spectacular optical observing site. And what's got the astronomers so excited is the temperature never varies. That's important, because with a telescope, heat causes it to expand or contract. And what you really want is a site where there's no expansion problems going on. And they found a spot in Antarctica where the temperature doesn't vary by more than 2 degrees, day and night, 12 months of the year. Doesn't matter what month you're there. Moreover, it's a place where there's no wind, and that also makes astronomers excited because wind jiggles a telescope. This place has no wind and is high altitude, almost 14,000 feet high.
50 degrees
below zero. No, it's a lot colder than minus 50. It has a very reliable, steady temperature of minus 95 degrees Fahrenheit. But it's actually more survivable than the South Pole, because in the South Pole in the southern winter, it'll get minus 100 with 100 mile per hour winds. And there's no way you can go outside when it's under those conditions. But this place has no wind, so it's actually more survivable. Yes?
How did you get in there, the 14,000? Is it a way to go there?
Well, it's a ridge. I mean, the highest elevation in Antarctica is a little more than 17,000 feet, but it's a place where the temperature varies and they got winds. This is a long ridge in between the South Pole and the coast, and a part of that ridge is just under 14,000 feet. And I think, you know, given that the government doesn't go broke, which is questionable, but there should be a number of telescopes on that ridge within a few years. Mm-hmm. Yes?
We were talking about the showers that will be coming up, you know, next week. Do you know any good observation points around here?
Okay, the meteor shower, yeah, it's going to be, I think it's the 13th of December that the meteor shower is going to peak. It's the best of the year. The best time to observe would be in the late hours. The later you observe, the better it will be. So, I mean, if you want really optimal observing, 4 a.m. to 5 a.m. would be best. But even if you observe at, say, 10 or 11 p.m., it'll be a lot better than observing at 7 p.m. So the later in the evening you observe, the better it will be. And it's called the Gemini meteor shower, which means the meteors will be radiating out of the constellation Gemini. So you kind of want to face. The best thing to do is just kind of lie on your back. Get some kind of chaise chair, lie on your back, get well dark adapted. A mistake a lot of people make is they go outside after watching TV and they expect to see something within 5 minutes. It takes a minimum of 20 minutes to dark adapt. And actually, ultimate dark adaptation takes about 2 hours. But after 20 minutes, your eyes will be fairly well dark adapted. Then you'll kind of want to lie on your back and look towards the constellation Gemini. And if you're not familiar with Gemini, well, most of you can probably find Orion. It's the brightest of the constellations, where you've got three stars for a belt, and then you've got three stars of the sword that hang down from the belt. Well, Gemini will be to the east of Orion. And it'll be a little higher in the sky, and it's dominated by two big stars, bright stars, Castor and Pollux. They call them the twins because they're kind of close together. And so look towards that region of the sky, but you'll be seeing meteors over the whole sky. So don't just look in one spot, but they'll tend to radiate out from Gemini. Yes. Okay, a couple of spots you can go. One would be Cow's Saddle. That's the easiest place to get to in terms of a short period of time. Cow Saddle, you go up towards Baldy Village. If you take the 210 freeway and get off of Baseline, you'll immediately pick up a road that will take you up to Baldy. And you'll go through, right when you get into Baldy Village, you'll make a left turn of what's called Glendora Ridge Road. Or those of you who live in Glendora, you can go the other way. You can drive along the Glendora Ridge Road. But I'll tell you, the saddle is probably, maybe a mile at most, maybe less than a mile from the junction that you take from Baldy Village. The elevation's about 5,000 feet, and you will be able to see the Milky Way from that location. We had a class star party there once, and we were all able to see the Milky Way. Now, if you want the ultimate place to go, that's within easy driving distance, that's about a half hour from here, a little more than a half hour to get to Cow's Saddle. A little less than an hour would be to drive up to a saddle point that's 6 miles west of Wrightwood. And the fastest way to get there, take the 210 freeway, get on to 15, but you'll see a highway. You get on what's called 138, then you get on 2, which is the Angeles Crest Highway. Head towards Wrightwood. You'll see a sign for Wrightwood right off of 15. you go through Wrightwood and keep going. And you'll find a saddle point at about 7,400 feet elevation. The nice thing about that place is they actually have a little building there with a flush toilet in it. And when you get cold, you tend not to be able to. Oh, you're going to need it. Okay. So, and it will be cool up there. I forget the name of the saddle, but it's really obvious. It's a big, wide saddle. There's a huge parking lot there. And again, just look at your odometer. It's about 6 miles directly west of Wrightwood. The one thing you've got to watch out is ski season. If they've got the lights on for the ski lifts, it will ruin the dark sky. But if you go late enough, they turn the lights off. So,
Is that Table Mountain Observatory?
I forget the name of the saddle. If you go online, you'll actually get the name of it. But that's probably the darkest sky you're going to get anywhere within easy driving distance of the L.A. Basin. And the nice thing about that place, there's no mountain road driving. I mean, it's basically a straight road. You won't be doing any of this curving stuff unless you go the back route. Yes.
You know, another place that I've gone is Mount Pinos, which is not hard to get to. It's paved all the way there.
Right.
And it's about 8,500 feet.
Right.
And it's in a bowl. And you get up there, and they have toilets as well.
Right.
And it's in a ravine almost.
Right. No, Mount Pinos is really good. A little bit longer drive, but it's a really good place. And keep in mind, with every 1,000 feet you go up, the temperature drops about 4 degrees. So you will need to dress more warmly, especially if you're lying on your back for a couple of hours. You might want to bring a sleeping bag with you, because it will get chilly. But as Dave mentioned, this is a really good chance to see a fireball. If you've never seen a fireball before in your life, this is a good chance to see one. Say, what's a fireball? It's a meteor that goes through the atmosphere that's so close to you that it actually has a measurable diameter from a naked eye observation. And so, for example, it might be a quarter of the diameter of the moon, or it might be a half diameter of the moon. I've actually seen them as large as 4 moon diameters across. And, I mean, it just lights up the whole sky. Shadows are everywhere, and it can be quite usually it leaves a smoky trail. It can be different colors. It can change colors as it goes through the sky. It can change direction. I can tell you from experience, we got a lot of UFO reports from fireballs. Because of the fact they change direction, leave a smoke trail, change colors, people think they're seeing UFOs, but what it is a fireball. Yeah. The 13th is the Geminis, yes. Is that tomorrow?
Yes.
Yeah, all right. Okay.
Tuesday night.
Yeah, it's pretty good for a couple of nights. It's actually about a 4-night window when you're going to see something, but it'll peak tomorrow night. But again, the later in the evening you observe, the better it will be. So, and also I'd recommend don't miss this lunar eclipse. It'll probably be the best lunar eclipse that anyone living in the L.A. area will see for about a decade. And that's because the eclipse is right there at midnight. And you get 2 lunar eclipses a year, but what's great about this one is in the right best possible location for people on the West Coast. So it'll be a really spectacular lunar eclipse. Yes. That will be the 21st.
Oh, 21st.
Yeah.
Pardon me? We'll start watching on the 20th.
Start watching the
20th. I'm disappointed because they're announcing this on the 20th, so you think, okay, that night I go out there. You know, so.
Yeah.
It's the 20th. You want to start watching on the
20th. Yeah, and you'll start, it'll start at 9:30 p.m., but that's kind of where the shadow of the Earth begins to impinge the sun. It won't reach total totality until a little bit after midnight, but it'll be total for about 72 minutes. So unlike a solar eclipse, you've got lots of time to see it. Yeah. Yeah, by 10:30, you'll actually be able to see something. You'll actually see part of the moon being shaded, and the shadow gets darker and darker. But at total eclipse, all you're seeing is the Earth shine on the moon. In fact, I like to get a telescope out because you can see the craters a lot more easily because it's not so bright as it is with a full moon. All you've got is the Earth shine illuminating the moon. Yes.
What would cause a fireball to change direction? What kind of objects are fireballs?
Well, it's a meteor that is going through the atmosphere, but it's close to the observer, which means that it's impacting the atmosphere. And it's a fairly, you know, the bigger it is, the bigger the fireball. And so the bigger the meteor, the more likely it is that it's going to break up. So sometimes I've seen fireballs that will split into four or five pieces. So you'll see that. But all of it is simply the piece of a comet or an asteroid that's interacting with the atmosphere. And a comet piece tends to be more spectacular than the asteroid piece because it gets bumped around by the atmosphere a lot more. Well, when it breaks apart, yeah, that's usually what's happening, is that the internal gases, ices, are being heated up and vaporized. And so that explains the spectacular colors, change of direction, the smoke trail, all of that. The ones you really got to watch out for are ones that you see that don't move but get bigger and bigger and bigger. That means it's heading right for you. So... And there's actually been people that have been hit by these things. I think there's like two or three instances where people have actually been injured by one of these things. So it does happen. There have been cars that have been hit by them. So anyway, that'll be tomorrow night. Yes?
The meteorites really hot or really cold?
Well, when they go through the atmosphere, they get hot. That's why you see them in the sky. You know, we call it a shooting star. It's because you've got this little piece of dust or rock that gets heated as it goes through the atmosphere, and therefore it glows.
Originally it's freezing cold.
Yeah, originally it's freezing cold, but when it hits the atmosphere, the atmosphere will heat things up to beyond 500 degrees centigrade. So that or hotter is what happens. So, and sometimes you'll actually see a fireball come through the atmosphere and it'll disappear. And that's a meteor that got completely vaporized by the Earth's atmosphere, so it doesn't even make it to the ground. Most meteors do not make it to the ground. In fact, as you look at the Geminides, you'll see that they streak across the sky and then stop. Well, where they stop is where they have run out of stuff and they've been completely vaporized. So it's really quite rare where you get something that hits the ground. It's got to be a fairly good size before it can survive going through the atmosphere. Yes?
I saw one when I was a kid and it came through.
Right. Well, if it's close enough, you'll actually hear sounds. So you might be able to hear something. Yes?
I was thinking with the heating, the incoming velocity initially is between 20,000 and 150,000 miles an hour.
Yeah, the typical velocity will run between 50 and 100 miles per second. So you can work out what that is per hour. Okay. A big enough one will give you a shockwave, yes. Keep in mind it was a meteor crashing into Arizona that created that nearly mile diameter crater that you see there just east of Phoenix. So yeah, if you're ever driving across Arizona, if you hit Winslow, it's worth going off the road. It's only a couple of miles off the main highway, and you'll see a meteor crater. And that crater, which is nearly a mile across and 350 feet deep, was caused by a rock only 100 feet in diameter. So it doesn't take a very big rock to cause a significant hole. Okay. Hey, I wanted to, before we get into our lesson in Psalm 139, this is actually related, is talk to you about a discovery that was announced Friday afternoon. In fact, I'll be doing a podcast on it tomorrow morning. But what it is... It's a group of archaeologists, and hey, I'm glad that we now have this course in archaeology available for you. But what they have discovered is a series of civilizations or archaeological ruins all around the Persian Gulf. And it's not on the edge of the Persian Gulf, it's in the Persian Gulf. And so archaeologists, in surveying the Persian Gulf area, have been looking in the water 20, 30 feet deep, and they have found the remains of 60 different villages. And quite sophisticated in terms of stone houses and pavement. These civilizations date actually a little before the Paleolithic Revolution, which is kind of dated around 11,000 years ago, 10 to 11,000 years ago, is when we see the first substantial evidence for villages, towns, roads, trading. But evidently, this discovery pushes that quite a bit earlier. It's just that we see it in what is now the Persian Gulf. They're finding remains that date anywhere from 8,500 years ago to several tens of thousands of years ago, and they have not yet taken diving thing. I mean, what this paper is suggesting is they need to go back and actually survey the entire Persian Gulf. Persian Gulf measures down to about 400 feet deep, and so they're saying since we're finding the remains of 60 villages all around the shore, or in the Persian Gulf itself, near the shore, that they actually were to look into the deeper areas, they would also find villages. Yes?
What city is it? What modern city is it close
to? There aren't any real city. Well, I mean, you've got the Persian Gulf cities along here. So you've got Bahrain, you've got, what's that place where they got the world's tallest building? Dubai. Dubai is right in here. So there's Qatar is right here, Oman. So yeah, there's cities all along there. But where they're finding these things is literally all the way around the Persian Gulf. So they're finding these villages in what is now 10, 20, 30 feet of water all around the Persian Gulf. And the researchers who made this discovery have commented that, of course, if you go back far enough, the Persian Gulf had a lot less water in it. In fact, if you go back just 40,000 years, it's possible that the entire Persian Gulf was dry. Yes?
The web article that I saw, maybe on MSN or something like that, made a point of the confluence of rivers.
Yes. Yeah, the researchers did that. And that's why I'm bringing this up, because it reads just like what you've got in Genesis chapter 2. In fact, let me just read that for you right now. Genesis 2 describes Adam and Eve, their creation, and also where God placed them in the Garden of Eden. And it says about the Garden of Eden, first it gives you the initial conditions. It says, when the Lord God made the earth and the heavens, no shrub of the field had yet appeared in the earth, no plant of the field had yet sprung up. The Lord God had not sent rain on the earth, and there was no man to work the ground. But streams came up from the earth and watered the whole surface of the ground. The Lord God formed man out of the dust of the earth. And then it goes on to talk about a river watering the garden flowed from Eden. And from there it divided, had four head streams. The name of the first is Pishon. It winds through the entire land of Havilah where there is gold. And the name of the second river is the Gihon. It winds through the entire land of Cush. The name of the third river is the Tigris. It comes along the east side of the Asher, and the fourth river is the Euphrates, which is on the west side of the Asher. And so it's referring to these four rivers, and if I can read to you from the announcement that came on Friday afternoon, here, let me just give you a quote. And it would have been in the ideal refuge from the harsh desert surrounding it, with fresh water supplied by the Tigris, the Euphrates, the Quran, and the Wadi Batan rivers, as well as by upwelling springs. And this is from the lead author, Rose. So he's making the point that in the Persian Gulf, you would have these upwelling springs, as well as water coming from four great rivers in that area. And he claims this would explain why you have such a lush civilization existing in what is now the Persian Gulf, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50,000 years ago. Yes?
Was the sea level lower then, or was the volcanic or plate tectonic, was the ground sunk?
The sea level was a lot lower then because if you're going back 30, 40, 50,000 years, the ice age is still in effect. And so the ice itself consumes a lot of water. But the other thing is that with ice thousands of feet thick over Asia and North America, it pushes those continents down, which forces the sea floor up. So the sea floor comes up, and of course the water level goes down because of how much seawater is now ice caps over the northern hemisphere. And it is such that if you were to go back 40, 50,000 years ago, this is what the Middle East looked like. And so most of the Red Sea was dry and the Persian Gulf was dry. Now, research is still going on this. Some researchers will claim that there were small pools of water that existed in the Red Sea and maybe some pools of water in the Persian Gulf, but it was almost entirely dry towards the end of the last ice age. But what I like about this discovery is it's confirming something we've been teaching here in the class for some time, that the Garden of Eden is not up in what is Asher. Let me give you the next slide. This one shows you the land of Asher where the Tigris and Euphrates flow. And that's traditionally where people have put the Garden of Eden. But the problem with that is you only got two of the rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates, that flow through the land of Asher. The land of Havilah, where there is much gold, is this region here in Arabia, the mountains of Havilah. And then this is the region of Cush. Now, Cush is often associated later in the Bible with Ethiopia. But the truth is, there would have been a land bridge connecting these two mountainous regions. So this is all the land of Cush. It also explains why we see so much genetic diversity in the people living in Ethiopia, because it would have been an easy walk for them to go up the Gihon into the land of Cush. Now, this is a satellite image. And this is not very good resolution here, but on a high resolution, which I got from my computer, you can actually see the faint outline of two ancient large rivers. And one does flow from the land of Cush, it's the Gihon. And actually the easiest way to see it on this slide is you can see that there is a depression that runs along here and cuts along into the mountains of Cush. This would be the Gihon. The Pishon flows right through here along and then up into the mountains of Havilah, actually down through here and down into here. So both the Gihon here, the Pishon here, flow into this part of the Persian Gulf. But what's interesting is if you were to trace the ancient flow lines of the Tigris and the Euphrates through the dry Persian Gulf region, and the Gihon and the Pishon likewise on into the dry Persian Gulf region, they all meet together at this location right there. So that would be, in my opinion, probably the best place to put the Garden of Eden. It's the only place where the four named rivers, both in the Bible and the four rivers you see here, they now have different names because today they're what we call Wadi, which means they're dry riverbeds. And water is only flowing in them in the rare times where they get rain. But if you go back in the days, at, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60,000 years ago, these were full flowing rivers because they would have been coming right out of this region. And so there would have been ice melt that would have been bringing in water. So all four rivers were big flowing rivers at that time. Today, you only get water coming out of the Tigris and Euphrates. We refer to these two rivers as Wadi, which means they're almost dry most of the year. They're dry almost all of the year, yes.
Yeah, the Bible says that God placed the garden when he banished Adam and Eve.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that was a temporary measure, or do you think if we actually found the spot where Eden is now, would there be some way in which we couldn't get there?
Well, it'd be hard to get to the Garden of Eden now because it's under about 300 feet of water. So, and you know, nobody's really looked. I mean, I think that's what's interesting. This paper is saying, look, we found these 60 civilizations underwater towards the shoreline of the Persian Gulf. And given that we know from the geology that all of the Persian Gulf or almost all of the Persian Gulf was dry, and the fact that it was well watered, not only do you have the four rivers coming in, but you have upwelling streams. We have evidence for that. And that given the quantity of fresh water was available, this would have been an obvious place for people to set up their civilizations. Therefore, they're calling upon divers to go in there and actually look for what exists at the deeper portions of the Persian Gulf. But simply based on what the Bible says and what you see in this paper about the four rivers. The four rivers they name here are identical to the four rivers we see in the Bible. This is the place where they would come together. And also you'd have the upwelling water, which matches a description we see in the earlier part of Genesis 2. I've got Nod here. Nod is the place to which Cain was banished. If you read Genesis 4, Cain was banished from the rest of humanity, and he was sent to the land of Nod. And what does it say about the land of Nod? It's east of Eden. And so probably somewhere in this region is where Cain and his the people with him and the city that he built would have been located relative to Eden. So this is probably an area of significant human population shortly after Adam and Eve, but Cain was banished to the east, to a less hospitable area. But what these researchers are pointing out is, given these four big rivers and the upwelling waters and the fact that this is a basin, it would have been a very fertile area and an obvious site for the launch of early human civilization. That's something else you see in Genesis 4, is the claim that shortly after Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel, you have significant advanced technology. It talks about metallurgy being exploited, tens of thousands of years ago. So it'd be good to kind of look in this area and see if we can uncover that kind of evidence. But yeah, it's a remarkable match what the Bible has taught for thousands of years. And it's the first time anybody's even looked to see if that biblical match was on target. So yeah, this is a significant discovery. Yes, Al.
So how old or when was Eden, when was the Garden of Eden established? Was it 8,000, 9,000 years ago?
Well, let me get to that in a minute, because what I want to show you next is, this is taking you back, say, 50, 60,000 years ago of God creating Adam and Eve. I'll give you the biblical evidence for you that in a minute. And then there's actually some scientific evidence for that. But what does the Bible tell us? Several generations after Adam and Eve, we have a flood. And there's actually some geological evidence for a natural berm right here at the Gulf of Hormuz. In other words, that there was a geological event that established a ridge of land, and that would have kept the water of the Indian Ocean out. And so the claim is that this remained dry for a significant period towards the end of the last ice age. But with the breaking of that berm, you'd have a massive flow of water from the ocean into the Persian Gulf. And this would be part of the explanation for the Genesis flood, as well as the 40 days and 40 nights of rain, as well as, say, a sudden warming period would have melted a lot of ice. And so there'd be three scenarios to explain the flood of Genesis. One would be the breaking of this barrier at the mouth of the Hormuz, with a flow of water from the Indian Ocean in. There'd be the 40 days and 40 nights of torrential rain, plus a warming episode, which would have melted a huge quantity of ice and snow on the mountains all the way around here. Bottom line is, you could have gotten a flood as big as this. Maybe that entire region was flooded, and would be consistent with a biblical claim that the entire human species that existed at that time was wiped out, except for Noah and the inhabitants on board the ark. So this is a significantly more devastating flood than what is traditionally taught in seminaries, the idea that it was just the Mesopotamian plain that was flooded. We're probably looking at something a lot more devastating than that. And keep in mind, if you break this berm here at the mouth of the Gulf of Hormuz, then you're going to get a mighty rush of water through. You got the rain flowing, the melting of the snow and the ice. You got water moving at such a fast pace, there won't be any survivors except for those on board the ark. Now, the flood could be smaller than this. It's possible it didn't come down quite this far into Arabia. It may have stopped right here, but it was certainly a flooded all the way up into the mountains of Ararat, which exist up towards the top of the slide. Okay, I see lots of hands here, so you're first. Go ahead. You're behind. You're the first one. Go ahead. Yeah. Sumeria is at the mouth of, let me go back here. Okay, there are one more. Okay, Samaria, see where they got Asher there? Samaria would be just slightly to the right of that, towards the mouth of the Tigris and Euphrates River. So that's the land of Samaria, and it is the place where we have the oldest evidence for civilization, where you got towns, roads, and trade going on. But this discovery is pointing out something even earlier than that. But they had to look in what is now the Persian Gulf to find that earlier evidence. So this would predate the Sumerian and the Akkadian civilizations by maybe even tens of thousands of years. And especially if you look in the deeper parts, we might find the most ancient dates. Yes?
The flood, it didn't flood the whole entire earth. It was that area, correct?
Correct.
But at that time, were there no evidence of any civilization, North America, South America, anything at all? No.
Well, this is why I think we need to look at what does the Bible claim for the date for Adam and Eve. And, I've talked about this before in the class, but we do have a very good historical date for when Abraham lived, both from the biblical genealogies and from the extra-biblical genealogical records we see in Samaria and Akkadia. So both extra-biblical and biblical historical records tell us that Abraham lived about 4,000 years ago. What's the error bar in that? About plus or minus 50 years. So that's a reasonably accurate date we have for Abraham, but we're also arguing that we've got a similar accurate date for Peleg. And you say, why Peleg? Well, the Genesis 11 genealogy gives you 10 names. The first name is Noah, the last name is Abraham, the fifth name is Peleg. So Peleg is number 5 in the genealogy. But if you flip, that's Genesis 11. If you flip back to Genesis 10, verse 25 tells us the world was divided in the days of Peleg. And you say, what is that referring to? Well, I think I actually have some slides on that here. Here we go. This is what the world looked like about 21,000 years ago. There was a 500-mile-wide bridge that joined. This is what is now Alaska right here, and this is Siberia, Kamchatka Peninsula. You can see the Aleutian Islands, and this is the Bering Land Bridge, about 500 miles wide. And after 21,000 years, actually around about 14,000 years ago, the bridge warmed up very significantly to where the average temperature was between 50 and 60 degrees Fahrenheit. That's warm enough that you're going to get grains growing all the way across the Bering Land Bridge, which means it would have been very easy for humans to migrate from Asia into North and South America. But that bridge, with the end of the last ice age, with the sea levels rising, and there's actually evidence in the Queen Charlotte Islands that the sea level was rising by more than 100 feet a century, maybe even several hundred feet a century. And so what happened is that the bridge disappeared about 11,500 years ago. So this is what it looked like 11,500 years ago. Today the bridge is about 80 miles wide. But with the breaking of that land bridge and the new colder temperatures coming in and the high winds coming in, it now became impossible for people in Asia to cut across and get into Alaska. Likewise, the Alaskans couldn't go back to Siberia. In fact, this bridge has effectively separated the people of North and South America from Asia for over 10,000 years. And we know this because of the legends of the Haida Indians in the Queen Charlotte Islands. There was a land bridge that joined the Queen Charlottes to the coast of British Columbia. And so these Indians simply walked into what is now the Queen Charlotte Islands, but in their legends it speaks about how the sea levels were rising so fast by more than a couple of hundred feet a century, that they were making plans to return to the mainland and could not pull it off. The sea levels rose so fast they were not able to get back to the mainland, and a strait opened up 60 miles wide, and some of us have been through that strait. It's kind of bouncy, and you get high seas there, and literally the Haida Indians were separated from the rest of humanity for 10,500 years. But their legends actually record in detail the events that have now been fully confirmed by radiocarbon dating. So the bottom line is, the bridge broke 11,500 years ago. And that breaking of land bridges is a worldwide phenomenon. There was a bridge joining England to France. That got broken. There was easy island hops that could take you from Asia to Australia. Those all got broken. And there was a bridge that joined Korea to Japan. That got broken. So all around the world, bridges were broken. And the date comes in at about 11,500 years ago as a result of carbon-14 dating, which means that if you've got Abraham living 4,000 years ago and Peleg living about 11,500 years ago, if the lifespans recorded in the biblical text are proportional to the passage of time, that puts the flood of Noah at roughly 40,000 years ago, give or take 15,000 years, and it puts Adam and Eve in at around 60 to 70,000 years ago, plus or minus about 20,000 years, which means we should be able to go back into the Persian Gulf and see if we can find evidence for significant civilization dating back 40, 50, 60,000 years ago. Nobody's looked. But what they have found already, announced just this past Friday, are these 60 villages that are now underwater with significant evidence for civilization, much earlier than anything we've ever received so far. Yes?
Homo sapien, I don't know if Homo erectus, I don't know if I'm using the exact term, but they've been dated as far as 100,000 years ago?
Oh, Homo sapiens goes back even earlier than 100,000 years ago, but we are not Homo sapiens. Homo sapiens is a title that includes the Neanderthals, it includes humans, it includes Homo sapiens idaltu, which is a tropical version of Neanderthal. All those species are lumped under the title Homo sapiens. Our species is Homo sapiens sapiens. Now, it's confusing because only our species has three names. All the other species have just two. But it's because, 50, 100 years ago, they came up with this label Homo sapiens for modern humans, and then they discovered they made a mistake. They actually included a lot of other species there, and so we've come up with a new title. Our species is Homo sapiens sapiens.
So were Adam and Eve the first Homo sapiens sapiens?
Correct.
But when did the first Homo sapiens come around? How many thousands of years?
Well, Neanderthals we know have been here for about 120,000 years. Homo sapiens idaltu goes back about 160,000 years. So yeah, they were around long before Adam and Eve.
What's the major difference between a Homo sapien and a Homo sapiens sapiens?
Well, a Homo sapiens sapiens immediately launched advanced culture. And so one of the dates we have for Adam and Eve are what we call the cultural big bangs. And what we see is that for our species, you've got an immediate exploitation of advanced tools, clothing, music, art, religious expression, language complexity. All that happens almost immediately. And the dates we're getting for those cultural big bangs fall between 40 and 50,000 years ago. Now, those dates are not necessarily coincident with Adam and Eve, because it would actually take a little bit of population growth before you're going to get archaeological evidence. But the earliest remains we have of humanity, we see that they actually have needles with holes in it. We find evidence that they were wearing clothing. And see, one of the best evidences for that is that with humanity coming out of the Persian Gulf, they began to move up into Mesopotamia and up into the mountainous regions and quickly displace the Neanderthals. Now, if you compare Neanderthal anatomy with human anatomy, the biggest difference, besides our brain structure, that there's a big difference in brain structure, but the other big difference is in their ability to withstand heat and cold. We human beings are ideally structured in terms of our anatomy to deal with high temperatures. Neanderthals are beautifully adapted to survive cold temperatures. But we quickly displaced the Neanderthals because we had clothing, they didn't. And so because of our clothing technology, we can inhabit the whole world. When we're in a hot place, we take our clothes off, or almost all of our clothes off, and we're in a cold place, we put lots of clothes on. And so they actually now have evidence that the early humans were living in climate zones, some of them that were 15 degrees centigrade colder than what Neanderthals could withstand, even though their bodies were much better adapted to cold than ours. For example, the Neanderthals have a barrel-sized torso, which makes it that you're going to lose a lot less heat if you've got a big torso. And then they got very short limbs. So if you got short legs and short arms, you're going to lose a lot less heat. And the other thing we notice is that they're the one species that has an enormous nasal capacity. No other species of life has it. It seems to be unique to the Neanderthals, which is one reason we argue they must be specially created. They can't be evolved because we see no other species that has this enormous nasal capacity. But the advantage of a huge nasal capacity, you can breathe cold air in, and it gets to heat up before it hits your lungs. We can't do that. I mean, I've lived in places where it gets down to 50 below zero. You have to wear special clothing when you're in that kind of a climate, because you need to warm the air up before it goes into your nostrils and down into your lungs. Once it gets colder than minus 40, you have the risk of burning your trachea and your lungs with that cold air, which is why we wear these parkas that have this hood that comes way out, and you get this little narrow thing. It's hard to walk around, by the way, one of those cold weather parkas, because your field of vision is so small. But that's what you need that gives a chance for the air to warm up. It's kind of like a Neanderthal nasal capacity. That's what a parka really is. Warms the air up, so when it hits your nose and goes into your lungs, you will survive. And contrast it with human beings. We human beings are tall and slender, which means we can radiate heat very efficiently, and also it means our bodies don't absorb as much sunlight as other creatures do. And so that's one reason why humans were so effective at hunting in the heat of the day, because the lions and the tigers, they're four-footed, and they absorb a lot of sunlight when they're out there in the field. Because we're bipedal and because we're so slim, we don't get that much sunlight hitting our body. Also, we don't have a lot of hair, so we don't trap that much heat. The heat goes out. And the other wonderful thing about the human body is designed with a very efficient sweating mechanism. We can sweat like no other mammal can sweat. Horses sweat, but we're by far the best sweaters. Maybe that's not the right word to use. The best sweating mammals that are out there. So as long as we can stay hydrated, we can handle the heat. But the Neanderthals are far better adapted than we are to the cold. That's assuming you're contrasting a naked Homo sapiens sapiens with a naked Homo Neanderthalensis. But the evidence is that humans quickly displace Neanderthals, even in the coldest of climates. Therefore, there must have been a clothing revolution. It's the only way that would have been feasible. And evidence for that is actually fine needles with holes in it. So clearly they were sewing pelts together. By the way, I'm arguing that that's one reason why it mentions rodents in Genesis 1. Sixth creation day, it speaks about the three categories of mammals that God gave us to launch our civilization. And rodents are on the list. But rodents are the best pelt producers on the planet, and be very easy for the first humans to begin raising these rodents. All you need to do is kind of throw food out and you'll attract them. We all know that, right? And then you can start exploiting their pelts for clothing use, and that helped humans invade into colder climates. Okay, I think you're next.
This is a related question. The Mediterranean Sea was also subject to this moistening of the earth, and I heard at the Straits of Gibraltar, or I read many years ago, that when that thing broke, there was like a half a mile dam, and the water at the bottom was almost supersonic coming into the Mediterranean, and it moved huge rocks. And they found an alluvial fan made up of big rocks, graded down to small rocks as you go across the Mediterranean. because the stuff gets smaller and smaller as the velocity decreases. Is that kind of effect here at the Straits, or haven't they figured that out at the Straits of Hormuz? You got big rocks around there, and then they get...
The research isn't as far along as it is for the Strait of Gibraltar. I mean, so that stuff is still needing to be done, is to actually figure out what was the full extent of the dam that blocked the Strait of Hormuz, and what happened when the dam broke. Again, kind of what this paper is calling for, we need to go into what is now the Persian Gulf and do that kind of research. Maybe we've got to have all these nations get at peace with one another so we can actually do the research to sufficient depth. Maybe that can be part of the plan to bring peace into that region. We'll see. Yes, go ahead, Al. Well, what's interesting, Al, is if you go into the different cultures of the world, there's actually more flood stories and flood myths than there are creation myths. And that makes sense, given that the flood happened probably 20, 30,000 years after the God creating Adam and Eve. And so you'd expect that there would be more extant flood stories than there would be creation stories. The difference is about 50. We can document about 100 different creation myths in the different religions and cultures of the world. There's over 150 flood stories. But what's interesting about those flood stories, I did this study several decades ago, is if you take those 160 flood stories and kind of plot a graph as to how close they are to the biblical story in terms of distance and geography, there's direct correlations. The greater the distance, say, from the Persian Gulf, the more distorted the story is relative to the biblical account, and the greater the time from that era, the greater the distortion. So you get the closest to the Bible stories in the region right around the Persian Gulf and the earliest ones. So that kind of explains why the Gilgamesh epic indeed is closest to the biblical story. It's the oldest written account, but not necessarily the oldest account.
It's the oldest written story of humans. Was it the Sumerians there?
Right. Well, the reason for that, Al, is that's the earliest language that took written form. And so what we notice in the other cultures of the world, as soon as their languages take written form, you've got a creation story and you've got a flood story. But of course, we'd expect that the Akkadians and the Sumerians would have the first written records, because those are the first languages that took written form. And you can read our book over here, The Genesis Question. We actually contrast the Gilgamesh epic with the Genesis account of the flood. And you can see they're very different. No, it's not true. There's great differences. One of the biggest differences you will see is that in the Bible, there's no political agenda. Whereas the one in the Gilgamesh epic is loaded with politics.
Politics?
Oh, yeah. I mean, both the Gilgamesh epic and the Enuma Elish, which is the Babylonian account of creation, are written in such a way as to justify a two-tiered society where they got the aristocrats running everything, and then you got the plebeians underneath them that are basically told, obey orders from the aristocrats and make sure the money flows in our direction, not in your direction. And so that's very much built into their accounts.
Has a Noah-like figure there, that whose family, the gods say, well, we're going to punish you because you've overpopulated and you're not acting right, you're a sinner, and so we're going to destroy the world. And so a flood comes, and I think the flood is only 6 days or something.
Right.
And then they get all these animals on there, and then he lets out a dove, or not a dove, different birds than Noah. But it's almost
parts of the story are very similar, but written in a very, the Gilgamesh epic is a lot longer and obviously has a lot of fanciful additions to what actually happened.
And don't forget the Jews were in captivity in Babylon for how many years? And so they picked up these legends and stories from the Babylonians, because they were captive there for a long time.
500. 500 years?
Yeah. So
yeah. I mean, the Genesis in about 15. Yeah, the 15th century is when the biblical account took written form. And again, the explanation there is that's the very first time that Hebrew became a written language. So at the very beginning of it being a written language, we see the recorded account. You know, as I've mentioned here in the class, there's good evidence that the book of Job, for example, predates Genesis by at least 600 years, but notice is written in a poetic style that's designed to be memorized verbatim. And so if you don't have a written language, in order to preserve your culture, you have to have people memorizing the important texts. And I've already mentioned the Haida Indians. That's what they did. Because we can look at their legends and realize it's a faithful historical record. They actually, in their legend, talk about the rising of the sea level, the forming of the Hecate Strait, and that's all been demonstrated. Everything they recorded actually happened exactly as they said. Clearly what they must have been doing is the elders were teaching the children, memorize this. They didn't have a written language, so they kept their historical records through memorization. So simply looking at the earliest written record does not tell you when the earliest record actually existed. Okay, you're next.
Okay, so what you're saying then is that the Jews had an oral record of creation, and Gilgamesh copied them, okay, and wrote it down. That's
no.
The obvious.
Scholars argue it is exactly as he stated, that the biblical record is first and these other people copied. And the reason why is you can see the distortions. But the first written record is not necessarily the first record. Well, for example. Okay. For example, the Haida legend has been dated to be earlier than 10,500 years ago, and it's a reliable record. And that's, you know, 6,500 years previous to the earliest records we have in Sumeria and Akkadia. So the Sumerians don't have the earliest records. The Haida Indians beat them by 6,500 years. You're in the back trying to get your hand up, so you're next. Go ahead.
That's our last question also. When you need to wrap up.
Okay. Yes.
So in the 6 days of creation, would they fall under when God created the land animals?
Okay, Genesis chapter 1, creation day 6, before it speaks about God creating the male and human, male and female humans, talks about God making three different kinds of land mammals. The short-legged ones, which are the rodents, and two kinds of long-legged ones, those that are easy to tame and those that are difficult to tame. You say, where do Homo sapiens idaltu and Homo neanderthalus fit in? They would be the long-legged land mammals that are difficult to tame. So they would fall in that category. So, also keep in mind, it doesn't mention all the things that God did in creation day 6. You're getting the highlights. Some Bible interpreters, when they look at where it says the long-legged land mammals, actually believe it's referring to quadrupeds, which means the Bible is saying nothing about the bipedal primates. And then maybe that's the way it is, because you look at the book of Job, it kind of reflects back on the creation day 6 mammals by saying these are the creatures that God gave humanity to launch and sustain civilization. And so in that sense, we'd be looking at four-footed long-legged land mammals, not the two-legged ones. And so in that case, the Bible would be completely silent on these bipedal primates that preceded Adam and Eve. Nothing disturbing. The Bible is also silent in dinosaurs. In fact, as evidence, the Bible is silent on anything that's not common knowledge to all generations of humanity. This is why you're not going to find Pi Masons in your concordance. Since we're the only people who have any idea what that means, it's not going to be in Bible texts that were written thousands of years ago. All of vocabulary in the Bible is designed to communicate to people at all generations. So naturally, the Bible is going to be silent on the Neanderthals. People only knew about them in 1856 is the first Neanderthal that was discovered. And so we would expect the Bible to be silent on that. On the other hand, I haven't got time to talk about it right now, but there's good reasons why God would make a dozen species of bipedal primates previous to creating Adam and Eve. It's the only way that the mammals that were most dependent upon would have survived the impact of the fall of man and the Garden of Eden. Because of the fall into rebellion against our Creator, humanity began to slaughter the very mammals that God intended that we would use to launch and sustain civilization. We believe it reasons to believe that God created a dozen different species of bipedal primates to help the mammals and the birds adapt to the coming future crisis of human beings in a sinful state. And evidence for that, let me just give you a quick piece of evidence. When humans invaded Africa, only 14% of the large-bodied bird and mammal species were driven to extinction. Africa had the full complement of bipedal primates, existing over 6.5 million years. When humans invaded Australia, where we have no evidence of bipedal primates predating human beings, 86% of the large-bodied bird and mammals were driven to extinction, and were driven to extinction in just a few hundred years. So, thank God for all these bipedal primates. Because of, when you have Thanksgiving next year, why don't you thank God for all those bipedal primates? Because of that, we actually can enjoy a turkey, a large-bodied bird. Anyway, with that, let me close. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for this amazing day and age in which we live, in which literally, on an hourly basis even, discoveries are taking place in your book of nature that are giving us more compelling evidence that you, God, are the ruler of the universe, the solar system, our planet, all of life, and us human beings as well. Lord, we thank you for your intimate control over everything that exists. And also, Lord, we can trust you that you're in control of everything that takes place in our life. Father in heaven, I pray you would increase our faith and help us to walk by faith and trust you implicitly to rule over us and do what's best for us from your perspective rather than our perspective. In Jesus' name, amen. The guy by the name of Rose. I mean, this is simply an announcement. The paper hasn't come out yet, so we don't know all the details. But